This is the New Yorker Fiction Podcast from the New Yorker Magazine. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at the New Yorker. Each month, we invite a writer to choose a story from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, we're going to hear The Toughest Indian in the World by Sherman Alexie, which was published in the New Yorker in June of 1999.
We all know that nostalgia is dangerous, but I remember those days with a clear conscience. We live in different days now, and there aren't as many Indian hitchhikers as there used to be.
The story was chosen by David Means, who's published four story collections. His first novel, Histopia, was published earlier this year. Hi, David.
Hey, Deborah.
So last time you were on the podcast, you read a story by Raymond Carver. What made you pick Sherman Alexie this time?
I'm not sure. I think it was, I suddenly felt that Sherman Alexie was being neglected a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a writer who goes way beyond the category of a Native American writer and is simply just a great storyteller and story writer. And I felt this story had some complexity that lent itself to discussion, I think, at some
mm-hmm.
level.
But mm-hmm. Did you read it when it first came out?
I think I read it in book form years ago, and occasionally I've brought it in front of my class to teach. So I've looked at it over the years again and again.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it like to teach it?
You know, the students really, really love it.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little perplexed by the ending, and they're not sure what to say, but they tend to embrace it.
Yeah, it's funny. When I read it again for this podcast, I thought, what are we going to say? Because it is this sort of formed thing.
Yeah.
You have to kind of break into its shell to talk about it.
It has this incredible structure that only a story can have. It spins around and around personal information, personal narrative, and then it gets to the pivotal action at the very end. I say this again and again. You're sort of retroactively cast back onto the earlier parts of the story, so it kind of forms a chemical reaction.
Mm-hmm.
You have to really sort of go back and think about how he leads you to this point.
You get to the end and you have to start again.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Very circular. Well, maybe we should just dive right in with it then.
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll talk some more after the reading.
Okay.
And now here's David Means reading The Toughest Indian in the World by Sherman Alexie.
The Toughest Indian in the World. Being a Spokane Indian, I only pick up Indian hitchhikers. I learned this particular ceremony from my father, a Coeur d'Alene, who always stopped for those 20th century Aboriginal nomads who refused to believe the salmon were gone. I don't know what they believe in exactly, but they wore hope like a bright shirt. My father never taught me about hope. From an early age, I was told that our salmon would never come back. And though such lessons may seem cruel, I learned to cover my heart in a crowd of white people. They'll kill you if they get the chance, my father said. Love you or hate you, white people will shoot you in the heart. Even after all these years, they still smell the salmon on you, the dead salmon, and that will make white people dangerous. All of us, Indian and white, are haunted by salmon. When I was a boy, I leaned over the edge of one dam or another, perhaps Long Lake or Little Falls, or the great gray dragon known as the Grand Coulee, and watched the ghosts of the salmon rise from the water to the sky and become constellations. Believe me, for most Indians, stars are nothing more than white tombstones scattered across a dark graveyard. But the Indian hitchhikers my father picked up refused to admit the existence of sky, let alone the possibility that salmon might be stars. They were common people who believed only in the thumb and the foot. My father envied those simple Indian hitchhikers. He wanted to change their minds about salmon. He wanted to break open their hearts and see the future in their blood because he loved them. Driving along one highway or another, my father would point out a hitchhiker standing beside the road a mile or two in the distance. Indian, he would say. And he was never wrong. Though I could never tell if that distant figure was male or female, let alone Indian or not. If the distant figure happened to be white, my father would drive by without comment. That was how I learned to be silent in the presence of white people. The silence is not about hate or pain or fear. Indians just like to believe that white people will vanish, perhaps explode into smoke, if they are ignored enough times. Perhaps 1,000 white families are still waiting for their sons and daughters to return home and can't even recognize them when they float back as morning fog. "Indian," my father would say again as we approached one of those dream-filled hitchhikers. Hell, those hitchhikers' faces grew red and puffy with the weight of their dreams. "We better stop," my mother would say from the passenger seat. She was one of those Spokane women who always wore a purple bandana tied tightly around their heads. These days, her bandana is usually red. There are reasons, motives, traditions behind the choice of color, but my mother keeps them secret. "Make room," my father would say to my siblings and me as we sat on the floor in the cavernous passenger area of our blue van. We sat on carpet samples because my father had torn out the seats in a sober rage not long after he bought the van from a crazy white man. I have 3 brothers and 3 sisters now. Back then, I had 4 of each. I missed one of the funerals and cried myself sick during the other one. "Make room," my father would say again, and he said everything twice. And only then would we scramble to make space for the Indian hitchhiker. Of course, it was easy enough to make room for one hitchhiker, but Indians usually traveled in packs. Once or twice, we picked up entire all-Indian basketball teams, along with our coaches, girlfriends, and cousins. 15-20 Indian strangers squeezed into the back of a blue van with 9 wide-eyed Indian kids. Back in those days, I loved the smell of Indians and of Indian hitchhikers in particular. They were usually in some stage of drunkenness, often in need of soap and towel, and always ready to sing. Oh, the songs! Indian blues bellowed at the highest volumes. We called them 49s, those cross-cultural songs that combined Indian lyrics and rhythm with country and Western and blues melodies. It seemed that every Indian knew all the lyrics to every Hank Williams song ever recorded. Hank was our Jesus. Patsy Cline was our Madonna. And Freddie Fender, George Jones, Conway Twitty, Loretta Lynn, Tammy Wynette, Charlie Pride, Ronnie Millsap, Tanya Tucker, Marty Robbins, Johnny Horton, Donna Fargo, and Charlie Rich were our disciples. We all know that nostalgia is dangerous, but I remember those days with a clear conscience. We live in different days now, and there aren't as many Indian hitchhikers as there used to be. Today, I drive my own car, a 1998 Toyota Camry, the best-selling automobile in the United States, and therefore the one most often stolen. Consumer Reports has named it the most reliable family sedan for 16 years running, and I believe them. With my Camry, I pick up 3 or 4 Indian hitchhikers a week, mostly men. They're usually headed home, back to their reservations or somewhere close to their reservations. Indians hardly ever travel in a straight line, so a Crow Indian might hitchhike west when his reservation is back east in Montana. "He has some people to see in Seattle," he might explain if I ever asked him. But I never ask Indians their reasons for hitchhiking. They were Indian, walking, raising a thumb, and I was there to pick them up. At the newspaper where I work, my fellow reporters think I'm crazy to pick up hitchhikers. They're all white and never stop to pick up anybody, let alone an Indian. After all, we're the ones who write the stories and headlines. Hitchhiker kills husband and wife. Missing girl's body found. Rapist strikes again. If I really tried, maybe I could explain to them why I pick up any Indian, but who wants to try? Instead, if they ask, I just give them a smile and turn back to my computer. My coworkers smile back and laugh loudly. They're always laughing loudly at me, at one another, at themselves, at goofy typos in the newspaper, at the idea of hitchhikers. I dated one of them for a few months, Cindy. She covered the local courts, speeding tickets and divorces, drunk driving and embezzlement. Cindy firmly believed in the who, what, where, when, why, and how of journalism. In daily conversation, she talked like she was writing the lead of her latest story. Hell, she talked like that in bed. How does that feel, I would ask, quite possibly becoming the only Indian man who has ever asked that question. I love it when you touch me there, she would answer. But it would help if you rubbed it about 30% lighter and with your thumb instead of your middle finger. And could you maybe turn the radio to a different station? KYZY would be good. I feel like soft jazz would work better for me right now. A minor chord, C or a G flat, something like that. Okay, honey? During lovemaking, I would get so exhausted by the size of her vocabulary that I would fall asleep before my orgasm, continue pumping away as if I were awake, and then regain consciousness with a sudden start when I finally did come, more out of reflex than passion. Don't get me wrong. Cindy was a good one, cute and smart, funny as hell, a good catch no matter how you define it. But she was also one of those white women who only date brown-skinned guys. Indians like me, black dudes, Mexicans, even a few Iranians. I started to feel like a trophy or like one of those entries in a personal ad. I asked Cindy why she never dated pale boys. White guys bore me, she said. All they want to talk about is their fathers. What do brown guys talk about? I asked her. Their mothers, she said and laughed, then promptly left me for a public defender who was half Japanese and half African, a combination that left Cindy dizzy with the interracial possibilities. Since Cindy, I haven't dated anyone. I live in my studio apartment with the ghosts of two dogs, Felix and Oscar, and a laptop computer stuffed with bad poems, the aborted halves of three novels, and some three-paragraph personality pieces I wrote for the newspaper. I'm a features writer, and an Indian at that, so I get all the shit jobs. Not the dangerous shit jobs or the monotonous shit jobs. No, I get to write the articles designed to please the eye, ear, and heart. And there is no journalism more soul-endangering to write than journalism that aims to please. So it was with reluctance that I hopped into my car last week and headed down Highway 2 to write some damn pleasant story about some damn pleasant people. Then I saw the Indian hitchhiker standing beside the road. He looked the way Indian hitchhikers usually look, long, straggly black hair, brown eyes and skin, missing a couple of teeth, bad complexion, crooked nose that had been broken more than once, big, misshapen ears, a few whiskers masquerading as a mustache. Even before he climbed into my car, I could tell he was tough. He had some serious muscles that threatened to rip through his blue jeans and denim jacket. When he was in the car, could see his hands up close, and they told the whole story. His fingers were twisted into weird shapes, and his knuckles were covered with layers of scar tissue. Geez, I said, you're a fighter, ain't you? The hitchhiker looked down at his hands, flexed them into fists. I could tell it hurt him to do that. Yeah, he said. I pulled back onto the highway, looking over my shoulder to check my blind spot. What tribe are you? I asked him. Lumi, he said. What about you? Spokane. I know some Spokane, haven't seen them in a long time. He clutched his backpack in his lap like he didn't want to let it go for nothing. He reached inside a pocket and pulled out a piece of deer jerky. I recognized it by the smell. Want some? He asked. Sure. It had been a long time since I'd eaten jerky. The salt, the gamey taste. I felt as Indian gets, driving down the road in a fast car, chewing on jerky, talking to an indigenous fighter. Where you headed? I asked. Home, back to the res. I nodded my head as I passed a big truck. The driver gave us a smile as we went by. I tooted the horn. Big trucks, said the fighter. I haven't lived on my reservation for years, but I live in Spokane, which is only an hour's drive from the res. Still, I hardly ever go there. I don't know why not. I don't think about it much, I guess, but my mom and dad still live in the same house where I grew up. My brothers and sisters, too. The ghosts of my two dead siblings share an apartment in a converted high school. Believe me, it's just a local call from Spokane to the res, so I talk to all of them once or twice a week. Smoke signals courtesy of U.S. West Communications. Sometimes they call me up to talk about the stories they've seen that I write for the newspaper. Pet pigs and support groups and science fairs. Once in a while, I used to fill in for the obituary writer when she was sick. Then she died, and I had to write her obituary. "How far are you going?" asked the fighter, meaning how much closer was he going to get to his reservation than he was now. "Up to Wenatchee," I said. "I've got some people to interview there." "Interview? What for?" "I'm a reporter. I work for the newspaper." "No," said the fighter, looking at me like I was stupid for thinking he was stupid. "I mean, what's the story about?" "Oh, not much. There's two sets of twins who work for the fire department, human interest stuff, you know." "Two sets of twins, ain't it? That's weird." He offered me more deer jerky, but I was too thirsty for the salty meat, so I offered him a Pepsi instead. It's a little-known fact that Indians can be broken up into two distinct groups, Pepsi tribes and Coke tribes. "Don't mind if I do," he said. He was obviously a member of a Pepsi tribe. "They're in the cooler on the back seat," I said. "Grab me one, too." He maneuvered his backpack carefully and found room enough to reach into the back seat for the soda pop. He opened my can first and handed it to me. I took a big mouthful and hiccuped loudly. "That always happens to me when I drink cold things," he said. We sipped slowly after that. I kept my eyes on the road while he stared out his window into the wheat fields. We were quiet for many miles. "Who do you fight?" I asked as we passed through another anonymous small town. "Mostly Indians," he said. "Money fights, you know. I go from res to res, fighting the best they have, winner takes all." "Geez, I never heard of that." "Yeah, I guess it's illegal." He rubbed his hands together. I could see fresh wounds. "Man," I said, "those fights must be rough." The fighter stared out the window. I watched him for a little too long and almost drove off the road. Car horns sounded all around us. "Geez," the fighter said, "close one, ain't it?" "Close enough," I said. He pulled his backpack closer to him, using it as a barrier between his chest and dashboard, an Indian hitchhiker's version of a passenger side airbag. "Who'd you fight last?" I asked, trying to concentrate on the road. "Some flathead kid," he said, "in Arlee." He was supposed to be the toughest Indian in the world. "Was he?" "Nah, no way. Wasn't even close. Wasn't even tougher than me." He told me how big the flathead kid was, way over 6 feet tall and 200 and some pounds. Big buck Indian. Had hands as big as this and arms as big as that. Had a chin like a damn buffalo. The fighter told me that he hit the flathead kid harder than he had ever hit anybody before. "I hit him like he was a white man," the fighter said. "I hit him like he was two or three white men rolled into one." But the flathead kid would not go down, even though his face swelled up so bad he looked like the Elephant Man. There was no referee, no judge, no bell to signal the end of the round. The winner was the Indian still standing. Punch after punch, man, and the kid would not go down. "I was so tired after a while," said the fighter, "that I just took a step back and watched the kid. He stood there with his arms down, swaying from side to side like some toy, you know? Head bobbing on his neck, like there was no bone at all. You couldn't even see his eyes no more. He was messed up." "What'd you do?" I asked. Hell, I couldn't fight him no more. That kid was planning to die before he ever went down. So I just sat on the ground while they counted me out. Dumb flathead kid, didn't even know what was happening. I just sat on the ground while they raised his hand, while all the winners collected their money and all the losers cussed me out. I just sat there, man. "Geez," I said. "What happened next?" "Not much. I sat there until everybody was gone. Then I stood up and headed for home. I'm tired of this shit. I just want to go home for a while. I got enough money to last me a long time. I'm a rich Indian, you hear? I'm a rich Indian." The fighter finished his Pepsi with one swallow, rolled down his window, and pitched the can out. I almost protested but decided against it. I kept my empty can wedged between my legs. "That's a hell of a story," I said. "Ain't no story," he said. "It's what happened." "Jeez," I said. "You would have been a warrior in the old days, ain't you? You would have been a killer. You would have stolen everybody's goddamn horses. That would have been you. You would have been it." I was excited. I wanted the fighter to know how much I thought of him. He didn't even look at me. "A killer," he said. "Sure." We didn't talk much after that. I pulled into Wenatchee just before sundown, and the fighter seemed happy to be leaving me. "Thanks for the ride, cousin," he said as he climbed out. Indians always call each other cousin, especially if they're strangers. "Wait," I said. He looked at me, waiting impatiently. I wanted to know if he had a place to sleep that night. It was supposed to get cold. There was a mountain range between Wenatchee and his reservation. Big mountains that used to be volcanoes. Big mountains that were still volcanoes. It could all blow up at any time. We wrote about it once for the newspaper. Things can change so quickly. So many emergencies and disasters that we can barely keep track. I wanted to tell him how much I cared about my job, even if I had to write about small-town firemen. I wanted to tell the fighter that I always picked up every Indian hitchhiker, young and old, men and women. Believe me, I pick them up and get them all a little closer to home, even if I can't get them all the way. I wanted to tell him that the night sky was a graveyard. I wanted to know if he was the toughest Indian in the world. "It's late," I finally said. "You can crash with me if you want." He studied my face and then looked down the long road towards his reservation. "Okay," he said. "That sounds good." We got a room at the Pony Soldier Motel, and both of us laughed at the irony of it all. Inside the room, in a generic watercolor hanging above the bed, the U.S. cavalry was kicking the crap out of a band of renegade Indians. "What tribe do you think they are?" I asked the fighter. "All of them," he said. The fighter crashed on the floor while I curled up in the uncomfortable bed. I couldn't sleep for the longest time. I listened to the fighter talk in his sleep. I stared up at the water-stained ceiling. I don't know what time it was when I finally drifted off, and I don't know what time it was when the fighter got into bed with me. He was naked, and his penis was hard. I could feel it press against my back as he snuggled up close to me, reached inside my underwear, and took my penis in his hand. Neither of us said a word. He just continued to stroke me as he rubbed himself against my back. That went on for a long time. I had never been that close to another man, but the fighter's calloused fingers felt better than I would have imagined if I had ever allowed myself to imagine such things. "This isn't working," he whispered. "I can't come." Without thinking, I reached around and took the fighter's penis in my hand. He was surprisingly small. "No," he said. "I want to be inside you." "I don't know," I said. "I've never done this before." "It's okay," he said. "I'll be careful. I have rubbers." Without waiting for my answer, he released me and got up from the bed. I turned to look at him. He was beautiful and scarred. So much brown skin marked with bruises, badly healed wounds, and tattoos. His long black hair was unbraided and hung down to his thin waist. My slacks and dress shirts were carefully folded and draped over the chair near the window. My shoes were sitting on the table. Blue light filled the room. The fighter bent down to his pack and searched for his condoms. For reasons I could not explain then and cannot explain now, I kicked off my underwear and rolled over on my stomach. I could not see him, but I could hear him breathing heavily as he found the condoms, tore open the package, and rolled one over his penis. He crawled into bed between my legs and slid a pillow beneath my belly. "Are you ready?" he asked. "I'm not gay," I said. "Sure," he said, as he pushed himself into me. He was small, but it hurt more than I expected, and I knew I would be sore for days afterward. But I wanted him to save me. He didn't say anything. He just pumped into me for a few minutes, came with a loud sigh, and then pulled out. Believe me, I wanted him to save me. I quickly rolled off the bed and went into the bathroom. I locked the door behind me and stood there in the dark. I smelled like salmon. "Hey," the fighter said through the door, "are you okay?" "Yes," I said, "I'm fine." A long silence. "Hey," he said, "would you mind if I slept in the bed with you?" I had no answer to that. "Listen," I said, "that flathead boy you fought, you know, the one you really beat up? The one who wouldn't fall down?" In my mind, I could see the fighter pummeling that boy, punch after punch. The boy too beaten to fight back, but too strong to fall down. "Yeah, what about him?" asked the fighter. "What was his name?" "His name?" "Yeah, his name. Elmer or something or other." "Did he have an Indian name?" "I have no idea. How the hell would I know that?" I stood there in the dark for a long time. I was chilled. I wanted to get into bed and fall asleep. "Hey," I said, I think you should leave now." "Yeah," said the fighter. He was not surprised. I could hear him softly singing as he dressed and stuffed all of his belongings into his pack. I couldn't tell what he was singing, but I wanted to know. I opened the bathroom door just as he was opening the door to leave. He stopped, looked back at me, and smiled. "Hey, tough guy," he said. "You were good." The fighter walked out the door then, leaving it open, and walked away. I stood in the doorway and watched him continue as he walked down the highway past the city limits. I watched him rise from the earth to sky and become a new constellation. I closed the door and wondered what was going to happen next. Feeling uncomfortable and cold, I went back into the bathroom. I ran the shower with the hottest water possible. I stared at myself in the mirror. Steam quickly filled the room. I threw a few shadow punches. Feeling stronger, I got in the shower and searched my body for changes. A middle-aged man needs to look for tumors. I dried myself with a towel too small for the job, then I crawled naked into bed. I wondered if I was a warrior in this life, and if I had been a warrior in a previous life. Lonely and laughing, I fell asleep. I didn't dream at all, not one bit. Or perhaps I did dream, but I can't remember any of it. Instead, I woke early the next morning before sunrise and went out into the world. I walked past my car. I stepped onto the pavement, still warm from the previous day's sun. I started walking. In bare feet, I traveled upriver towards the place where I was born and will someday die. Believe me, at that moment, if you had broken open my heart, you could have looked inside and seen the thin white skeletons of 1,000 salmon.
That was David Means reading The Toughest Indian in the World by Sherman Alexie. The story appeared in The New Yorker in June of 1999 and was included in Alexie's collection, The Toughest Indian in the World, which was published by Atlantic Monthly Press in 2000. David, one of the first things I felt on rereading this story this week was what a dismal time to be reading stories about non-white cultures in America.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's that line at the beginning where the father tells his son, you know, they'll kill you if they get the chance. You know, yeah. Love you or hate you, white people will shoot you in the heart.
Yeah.
And I suppose that that's a reality that Native American or Indian cultures have been obviously living with since white people came here.
Yeah.
But also to see it expressed in that way, this week.
Yeah, yeah. It's the thing I found refreshing, or, you know, when I was reading the story and sort of getting a feel for it again, maybe even refreshing isn't the word, the thing that touched me was that a story or a piece of literature can implicate you into the culture. It can actually make you become, at least temporarily, part of something that you're not. And I felt like even at that point in the story where we're, you know, where the father's lecturing the son and giving him this acute, sharp information that he'll carry with him for the rest of his life. Yeah. Even at that point, I felt like I was being told something. I was mm-hmm. being about whiteness, mm-hmm. about being white and what it means, that you are a in the sort of dynamic of a person's life, just by being white, you are projecting something that is fearful.
Mm-hmm. That triggers fear, yeah. That you're, no matter what, you're playing a role. He also opens the story with that image of these Indian hitchhikers who wear hope like a bright shirt.
Yeah.
You know, who don't want to believe that the salmon are gone. And the salmon obviously comes back throughout the story. What is that salmon? Is it a metaphor? Is it a symbol for Pacific Northwest culture? I mean, quite literally, the salmon had been depleted by white fishing, overfishing.
Well, I think it ends up becoming, and that's sort of what I was saying about implicating you and drawing you into something that's beyond your own culture. You only feel what salmon means and what it is to him. It is a deep symbol of not just nature, but of something even more than that, because in the story ends with that image. At least it did in the original, in the book version that Sherman Alexie published. There was this image of him tearing himself open, and the salmon were inside him.
Yeah, is that both, it's okay. In both versions.
Okay,
yeah.
I couldn't remember from here.
What's inside him is the skeletons of the salmon.
Yeah,
not actual living salmon, but their skeletons, their bones.
Yeah, that's and it's but it's taken to this mythic level.
Yeah.
Of you know, he is a constellation. He is something beyond himself.
He is a salmon,
and. Which kind of sounds like my mother is a fish, which reminds me of Faulkner. But it's a perplexing mystery how you interpret the ending of this story. I think it ties in with the sex at the end, with the need for communication. Mm-hmm. I'm jumping to the end, but I see that scene as a form of touch being a way of communicating, a form of dialogue. I'm kind of working on a theory that and this is a preposterous theory, that in all of literature, sex scenes are really simply modes of communication and dialogue between the two characters.
Yeah.
So I kind of look at that scene as a way of talking, of learning a new way of speech, and then he walks out and becomes, you know, he becomes mythic.
Mm-hmm. They both do, yeah. Well, so let's go to that sex scene. Do you see it coming?
I feel this sense of disequilibrium in the character. The scene with Cindy, and the fact that Cindy wants to map things out for him and wants to tell him what to do, what's good and what's bad, and I feel that he's kind of in between several worlds sexually and then also with his identity. He's hovering and he's looking for a place to stand. So. I didn't find it surprising that the sex scene happened.
Yeah. Well, we have these two characters. We have this sort of citified Indian who never goes back to the reservation, who works with all white people, dates white women. And then we have this other Indian who, at least for the narrator, epitomizes sort of a real Indian, you know?
Yeah.
He's going around from reservation to reservation. He's tough. He's fighting. He's pulling out his deer jerky. he's in the Pepsi tribe.
Yes, he's the toughest Indian in the world.
So he's, even for the narrator, is a sort of symbol of something. And I suppose, you know, the narrator in a way complains about Cindy typecasting him. You know, he's just another brown man, or he's, you know. And about the people at the newspaper typecasting him and so on. When he looks at this fighter, is that not what he's doing? He's sort of fetishizing.
I think he is. I think we all do that at some level, maybe. You know, at some primal whatever level, we're all constantly looking for some new mask to put on or identity. But I think with this character, it's partially about masculinity. And Cindy is the one that is going around messing around with different identity types and seeing what alchemical things happen, you know, and Alexei makes that clear. But this character is sort of hovering between between the white world, but he's hovering and the res. That's sort of Alexei's landscape.
Yeah.
In the book version of this book, which is slightly different, he plays a little more with the giving you the sense that this character is intentionally putting on the Indian identity to connect with the fighter guy.
Well, he's very drawn. You know, I don't know if it's a physical attraction, sexual attraction, but he's very, very drawn to this man. He can't take his eyes off him. He drives off the road because he can't stop looking at him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's fascinated. Perhaps he doesn't know why.
Yeah, I don't think he does. I think he's attracted, you know, because it's mentioned a few times the sort of beauty of the scars, mm-hmm. and the beauty of the damage that's been done. Mm-hmm. He's drawn to it. He doesn't understand why, which is to me the mystery of that literature exposes. You know, it can't be explained exactly why one person comes into our life, even as a hitchhiker, and really does this sort of chemical thing that changes everything. Mm-hmm. Maybe not forever, but at least for the night, you know, it's like that.
Yeah, well, it also begs the question, you know, is this, the salmon isn't a real salmon. It's not a salmon, you know, that's swimming that you might catch and eat. Is this fighter a real Indian? Is he a symbol? Is it something that, he, you know, he wants to, in a sense, be taken by, possessed by?
Well, he's stuck in a short story.
Yeah.
And the nature of a story of this length is that the symbols, you know, everything is symbolic at some level. It's almost like you can't see him as anything but something symbolic in the context of everything that happens.
Yeah. There's that line that he has during when, you know, they're having sex. He says, I'm not gay. I'm not, you know, but I wanted him to save me. And he says it twice.
Yeah.
I wanted him to save me.
Yeah.
What do you think saving means?
Well, I just read that as the way we all want to be saved, mm-hmm. without getting corny here. But yeah, I mean, I just read that as, you know, he's lonely, he's isolated, even in the context of the hotel room, you know, hotel rooms are isolated and they're isolating and they're lonely. Yeah. And he just, and I think there's a very complicated thing going on with the saying, I'm not gay. You know, it's like, that's probably been said a lot.
In exactly that situation.
and it kind of makes me think that, you know, language just can't do justice to the complexity of the human behavior. It's like, well, you are gay. At least tonight you are. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how to address that. But
I mean, the sex itself is quite one-sided.
It is.
he makes a point of pointing out that this, you know, tough guy, this fighter guy, is very small.
Yeah, exactly.
says it twice.
Yeah.
So there's something. I mean, both comical and violating and rescuing in this scene. I mean, it's not a very long scene, but much happens in it.
Yeah. It's mechanical.
Yeah.
It's like you know, it's like putting the accelerator to the floor or something. There's something a little mechanical about it. But it's touching. It's touching, you know, because of the way he tells the fighter to leave.
Well, why does he tell him to leave? Why do you think? And why is the fighter just not surprised? He just sings a little song and
says
you are good.
It feels like it's woven into the nature of Native American experience, and it ties a little in with the sort of taking the long road around to get to where you're going, which is a trope that goes through Native American literature. It's like this, I'm going west, but first I'm going to go north and south and east, and I'm just going to wander around. And maybe at some level, this might be pushing it, but maybe at some level the sex is just another form of wandering.
Yeah.
You were good, and then they part ways in a way that is very not white.
Yeah.
They, you know, okay, goodbye. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna sit around and analyze this for the rest of my life, and work it out. We follow the path that the world leads us through, and that's the way it is. It's a different way of thinking, I think, than quote unquote whiteness would project onto the scene.
Yeah.
And it, maybe that mirrors a little bit Cindy too in that mm-hmm. scene. With her, like, deliberateness of telling him what she likes and what she doesn't
yeah.
like.
And him falling asleep until
and
he
him
comes.
Falling asleep and, yeah.
Exactly. Humping away in his sleep.
Yeah.
Because he's so bored.
That's hard. I can't imagine how you could do that, but.
it's a story. It's symbolic. There's this sort of amazing thing that happens, though, afterwards to our narrator, who's energized.
Yeah.
And wound up by this and says, you know, maybe I'm a warrior, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, you would think actually it was sort of, you would expect the opposite reaction, that yeah. it was perhaps humiliating in some way, but it's not. What he feels he's been, in a sense, he's had something essential passed into him.
Yeah. I kind of read the masculine, the search for masculine identity, looking for a way to think about being male mm-hmm. in that character. Just trying to, and when you come in contact with someone who is physically, you know, brutally into this sort of identity of manhood as a fighting yeah. kind of scarred yeah. person, there's going to be a complex reaction.
Yeah. But even earlier, you know, he really, in a way, misreads the fighter. You know, he tells yeah. a story about the boy that he was hitting and hitting and he just wouldn't fall down. And finally he, you know, sits down and gets counted out as a loser.
Yeah.
And the narrator's like, oh, you would have been a killer. You know,
right.
I mean, in fact, he just said, I didn't kill him. I chose not to. If I'd yeah. gone on hitting him, it would have killed him. He's shown himself to be compassionate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the narrator interprets this as a story of, you know, killing and stealing the goddamn horses and is exultant
yeah.
about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think is happening with that?
Well, maybe at some deep level, really deep level, it's a critique of the sort of idea of war, of being a warrior as mm-hmm. an answer
fighting.
To malehood.
Yeah.
You feel like the fighter has thrown in the towel and said, no more of this for me.
He's going home, yeah.
And yet the main character, the narrator, it's more like he's trying to head in the direction of the fighter. So they meet kind of halfway.
Yeah.
And he feels better about himself at the end and more centered somehow. Obviously, mm-hmm. he's centered in this with his tradition and
yeah.
with his people.
He smells like salmon.
He smells like salmon. And yeah, yeah.
But he starts off the story in a way just living with ghosts, right? You know, he's living with the ghosts of his dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
Felix and Oscar. He talks about how his dead siblings live in a converted apartment in the high school.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, very, very local, very specific. And then, you know, you have these ghosts of the salmon in the sky as constellations. And so then you get to the end, and this fighter walks out the door and basically walks up into the sky and becomes one of them.
Yeah.
As he becomes a salmon, he becomes a ghost. Our narrator, inside him are 1,000 salmon skeletons. He's heading off to the place where he was born and where he'll die. Do you think he's literally going to the reservation? What do you think is happening?
I'm going to go back again to the thing that a short story can do that nothing else can do, which is ride that line between poetry and longer fiction. It's part of what the story ends up being, you know. It's, at some level, the texture of the story is about myth. So I just read it as a endpoint to the narrative. Throwing everything back on everything you read before you got to that point in the mystery of what happens between the two people in the hotel room. Which is, a long-winded roundabout way of saying I have no idea exactly what that ending really means.
Yeah.
You know, it's, again, it allows you to become integrated into a cultural moment and makes you think in a way that you normally might not think.
I read an interview with Sherman, and it may have just been that he was irritated by the questions, but he sort of said quite directly, this is about a man grappling with his sexuality. It's not about him grappling with his identity, you know, and
which is totally
funny.
Yeah, and totally true. It really is just a man grappling with his,
with his sexual identity. But,
yeah.
But he said in the interview, one of the points I was trying to make in that story is that being Indian is just part of who we are.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you do feel throughout the whole story this narrator reaching for his Indian.
Yeah.
Indianism, yeah. If you can say it that way.
Well, it's simply the miasma or the stuff around the action of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, the real important thing in the story, I agree with Sherman, I think I understand what he's saying, is the things that happen between the fighter and the main character and what happens to them. In other words, both things are right. I mean, you can't just look at it as an attempt to sort of teach you something about the culture or to inform us about the Native American culture.
Though, interestingly, there is a little bit of that quality there. There's a bit of the, you're a Martian entering my world, you know. You didn't realize that Indians call each other cousin even when they're not related, or that there are Pepsi tribes and Coke tribes. So there's a slight touch of, I'm right, I know if you're reading this, you may not be, you may not know these things.
Yeah, and the structure, the way it's built, does that too, because you have a lot of in the foreground, you have a lot of background about the father and the hitchhikers, and Indian hitchhikers are this, and
the starting with the father is interesting, especially when Cindy says, I won't date white guys because they always talk about their dads. And we've started this with him talking about his dad. There's another line where he says, living with nostalgia is the most dangerous thing.
Yeah.
And that seems to be all he's living with, in a way.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The book version is slightly tweaked and has a little more self-awareness of his playing identity. So when the fighter gets in the car, he informs the reader that he intentionally uses certain words to let the fighter know that he's Native, he's part of the res.
Yeah.
He's more aware of playing around. And that kind of shows the complexity of being between two worlds and how you have to navigate a lot to find your position.
Perhaps what he admires in the fighter is that he really is living in one world in a way.
Yeah.
He's not torn between two.
He seems like it, yes.
Seems that way. Yeah.
I think Sherman Alexie said in an interview that he grew up Catholic and Native American, so he had guilt squared. Two levels of guilt.
Well, there's another thing. The narrator says, believe me, about five or six times in the story, at different points, and just, the most intense is I wanted him to save me, believe me, I wanted him to save me. But he says it several other times.
Yeah. And
why do you have to beg so hard for us to believe you? There's something, perhaps he's not believing himself.
Exactly, yeah. I didn't really think of that. There is this sort of urgency to, when he says, I'm not gay, it's like this urgent desire to make sure you believe him and make sure you're part of his side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's very complicated.
Yeah, very interesting to think what story the fighter would tell. Picked up by this very confused young man.
I get a feeling the fighter wouldn't even remember this day. It was just one more in a long line of many sort of random events.
Random hitchhiking moments. And, of course, he's up in the sky anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sherman Alexie has published 25 books of poetry, short fiction, and novels, including The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven, War Dances, and most recently, the young adult novel, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. David Means's books include the story collections The Spot and The Secret Goldfish, and the novel Histopia, which was longlisted for this year's Man Booker Prize. He's been publishing fiction in The New Yorker since 2004. You can download more than 100 previous episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast in the iTunes Store. You can download the weekly audio edition of the New Yorker through iTunes or Audible.com. On the Writer's Voice podcast, you can hear short stories from the magazines read by their authors. You can find the Writer's Voice and other New Yorker podcasts on your podcast app. You can also hear readings of New Yorker fiction on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps available from the App Store or from Google Play. Tell us what you thought of this program on our Facebook page, or rate and review us on iTunes. The New Yorker Fiction Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff and Alex Barron of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.